101.9 High FM, One Nation, One Station.
Peter Becker, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Howard. You've seen straight through us, I see.
Yeah, you know, we are sharp. You guys think you're crafty, but we're onto you. It's really, it's really got nothing to do with, yeah, exactly. But, Peter, thanks for joining us this morning. Are earthquakes a thing in the Western Cape? All of a sudden, we're hearing about more and more of them.
Yeah, that's true. And it is the place in the country with the highest tectonic plate activity, which leads to earthquakes. More earthquakes are recorded in the Joburg area, but that's because of what all the mining that goes on there. So you get minor quakes for that. But tectonic origin earthquakes, the West Cape is the highest in the country, which is why it's not really the best place to build a nuclear plant. In terms of what you've said about is it increasing, I think so, yes, indeed. I was just trying to remember when I last felt an earthquake. We had two or three in September, I think one off the coast of PE and one in Kraaifontein near Belleville, and another one there as well. But before that, I don't remember the previous one. So we've had three or four in the last 2 months. So that does seem to indicate that some kind of increased activity is going on. And that is a level of concern.
Is this part of a natural cycle where you'll have a whole lot of earthquakes happening and then it sort of dissipates or goes quiet, or does this indicate something else?
Yeah, I mean, yes, it is a cycle. And as you probably know, the continents are actually moving across the surface of the world very, very, very slowly. But they are not on oiled bearings. They are just rock scraping on rock. So what happens every now and again is there's some kind of stuck and slip sort of effect, and that creates a jar. And the amount of force, you can imagine the momentum of a continent moving, the amount of energy that's released in some of the events is huge. And the earthquakes we've had here, I think it was 3.5, this last one. Previously, they were 2.5. So that's also a worrying trend, is they seem to be getting stronger from the very few data points we've got. But yeah, the concern is if one happens of a very severe magnitude. I think there was one in Ceres in 1969, which they think didn't have measurements back then as we do now, but they think it was about 6 point something. And the Coburg plant has been designed with the intention of theoretically withstanding a 7-level magnitude earthquake. So, you know, it's a question really, if you look at very long timescales, not will a big earthquake happen, but when will it happen?
And just talk me through the precautions at Coburg. What happens if there is one of these? As you say, it's built to withstand 7, but obviously not everything exists in a perfect world. Take us through the situation there.
Yes, I was careful to say theoretically to withstand 7, because this is ESCOM we're talking about. No more need to be said.
I'm loving this. You're more cynical than I am this morning. And it's not.
You set me off, Howard.
I'm sorry.
So when they built Coburg, it was actually the very first plant that they built with an attempt of what they call a seismic raft, which is a foundation that's supported on rubber pads with the intention that if there's a shaking of the ground, the rubber pads absorb some of that. Now, a few things. Firstly, it was the first plant with that design built. And later plants, they put something called horizontal buffering, which means that if they have rubber pads on the sides as well, so that if it exceeds what they thought it was, it wouldn't be concrete hitting concrete, it would be absorbed by rubber. They didn't do that at Coburg. They realized the need for that, and they did it later. So that's one level of concern. Another level of concern, if these neoprene pads have been sitting there in a marine environment for nearly 40 years, and what Coburg is saying, or ESCOM is saying, is they want to now say, yeah, it was designed to last 40 years, this foundation and these pads and the entire plant, but we're going to try and ask for permission to run it an extra 20 years beyond its planned 40-year lifetime.
Oh, gosh.
So in terms of your plan question, that's the mitigation. of course, there's also an emergency plan what to do if something goes horribly wrong.
Yeah, so it is a concern. And, of course, I think with 2020 having just happened and all of us having watched the Chernobyl series, that our heightened anxiety is probably not unreasonable, or is it?
Yeah, and I think if we went back a year and you said, hey, do you think it's likely we'll all be locked in our homes and forbidden to leave because a global pandemic is spreading around the world, we all would have said no, and it's true, it would have been unlikely. But unlikely doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Mm. So when we have something with a risk like Coburg, I believe it's important to look at the benefit of keeping Coburg running and balancing that against the chance, admittedly a small chance, but the chance of a major earthquake, for example, or simple human incompetence, since you've watched Chernobyl, causing some kind of massive failure at Coburg.
Take us through a worst case scenario, and it is worst case, and we're not saying that this is something that is likely. We're saying it's very unlikely. But just give us a perfect storm, and what could happen there?
Yeah, so I actually visited Japan a year after the accident there, and toured the area and so on. So I saw this firsthand. So firstly, there is an emergency plan in place. So when ESCOM tries to say there's no risk, nothing will go wrong, the logical question is, well, why do you have an emergency plan? They must feel that there's a chance of this happening, otherwise they would not bother to have this plan. So worst case scenario is that there's a meltdown at the reactor. And this isn't like a nuclear bomb exploding. It's not a big flash and Hiroshima type thing. Normally what would happen in a meltdown is there'd be a breach of the containment structure, and there'd be a plume of radioactive material and dust that gets shot up by some kind of force into the air. That's what happened at Fukushima. Now, the problem is that dust gets carried by the wind, and it contains radioactive material. And if that dust gets on you, or worse, inside you, it starts irradiating you from the inside. And that, again, is not something that's an immediate problem. It's something that will then increase the chances of you getting cancer. And the more exposure you get, the more chance you've got of getting cancer over the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and so on. So the worst case scenario would mean that houses have to be abandoned, that tens of thousands of people have to leave their homes and cannot return for about 300 years. So the blow to the at a personal level to people would obviously be huge, the trauma of all that. The blow to the country economically would be huge. Because how would those people get housed? ESCOM can't afford to do it. You know, they're already $480 billion in debt and counting. So the economic impact would be huge. The impact on tourism. Would you want to come to Cape Town? Never mind pretending that we have an earthquake. Imagine if there was really a nuclear disaster. You know, the interesting thing about Fukushima is it's the name of a province. I didn't know that before I went there. I thought it was the name of a plant. No, it's the name of the province. So if it happened here, it would be called the Western Cape nuclear disaster. Who would want to come on holiday to the Western Cape? Who would want to buy wine from the Western Cape or dairy products? It is cataclysmic at an economic level if something like that were to happen.
The benefits of Coburg, can you just take us through that for those of us who aren't particularly up to date with this?
Sure. Coburg was built for one reason, and that was to manufacture plutonium for the apartheid government to be able to produce a nuclear weapon. So that's not conspiracy theory. That's well documented. That's the reason why it was done. Mm. And in fact, that's the only reason any country has built a nuclear power plant.
Incredible. That's so interesting. Yeah. That is so interesting. Yeah.
That's why no private bank will actually finance a nuclear plant. The World Bank has a policy they won't finance a nuclear plant because it's inherently risky. The only way it gets done is a government puts up the money. So that was the initial motivation. At the moment, Coburg has two reactors, and they get refueled every 18 months when one goes down. But when they're both running, they produce somewhere around 5% of our current electricity demand. When one is being refueled, it's more like somewhere around 2-point-something%. So if you look at that in the big picture, and you say we've got one nuclear plant in Africa, because of that, we have this intractable problem of high-level waste and spent fuel. We've got this fear of an earthquake causing some kind of major disaster. We have to have an emergency plan in place, and all for 2 to 5% of electricity. Surely there's a better way. And yes, there is a better way. And we know that new renewable plants are coming online all the time. And that is going to fill up the gap as coal power stations get retired when they come to the end of the life. We're moving forward into a future which is based, everyone agrees, the far future is based on renewable energy. So let's get there as quickly as possible, and let's forget the dinosaurs like Kuburg, which its attendant risks and problem with waste. Let's allow it to come to the end of its designed life in 2024. Let's shut it down, and let's start focusing on what to do with those, I think it's 1.5 million kilograms of high-level waste that no country in the world has yet come up with a plan what to do.
And of course,
making more of the waste, for heaven's sake. Why carry on, you know?
Absolutely. And especially South Africa with our incredible climate where we've got sun, we've got wind energy. Yeah. There is just so much that, that we could do on, in terms of renewable energy, but somehow, well.
You spot on, Howard. Like, look at is it PE or Cape Town that's called the Windy City?
PE. Well, it's PE and Musenberg, I think.
Okay. So you're right about the wind. In terms of sun, the technical term is insolation. That means the intensity of the sun hitting the ground. And the Northern Cape is the second most intense in the world. So that, and in terms also of the lack of cloud cover and rain, which is not good in some ways, but it's very good for solar plants. So we have the ideal free energy that is available from the sun and from the wind, and it doesn't produce any waste. There's no risk. It takes 6 months to build a wind turbine. It takes 15 years to build a nuclear plant. It's really a no-brainer. We should be moving forward. And the only reason we haven't got that renewable energy in place is because our ex-president Zuma repeatedly blocked it.
Yeah,
the whole IPP program.
Absolutely. And certainly I was in the commodities and mining industry. Many of these organizations were very, very happy to start putting up their own plants to find ways to produce their own energy, but it was proved absolutely impossible to do given the regulations. And of course it was only about one thing, which was protecting the monopoly that Eskom and the hold that Eskom has over the whole country. Peter Beck, I do need to leave it there. Sorry, a final point you're making?
No, you've summed it up really well. and then that is the answer. We need to unblock what is stopping renewable energy coming online, because it's done all over the world. We know how it works. We know the costing. Nuclear power is a very risky thing to embark on, and there's really no rational reason to keep going on that path.
Absolutely right. It is 8:22. Peter Becker is the spokesperson for the Kuburg Alert Alliance. Great chatting to him this morning.